It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up on today's show, how we learn about the Holocaust, and we'll meet an Iowa woman who recently completed the Iditarod. But first, let's talk about the fun drive. The quiet portion of our spring membership drive ends on Tuesday. That means we've got just over 5 days to reach our goal of $385,000 without interrupting any of the shows you love. And we are making tremendous progress, but we need to hear from you. You can make your donation at iowapublicradio.org or call 800-235-2665. And if you give right now, you have a chance to win a two-night stay in downtown Chicago at the Hilton and a pair of tickets to see Hamilton in Chicago. So give now. You'll be entered into that drawing and our grand prize sweepstakes for a trip of a lifetime to Iceland. iowapublicradio.org.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet Emily Maxwell, a musher who recently completed the Iditarod. But first, there comes a time when every new generation has to learn about one of the greatest atrocities in world history, the Holocaust. How we learn about it and how we remember it is evolving. This year's Yom HaShoah Holocaust Remembrance Day is on April 12th, and with me now are two professors who are working to help their students and the public connect with this history. Dan Reynolds is the Seth Richards Professor of Modern Languages at Grinnell College and the author of Postcards from Auschwitz, Holocaust Tourism, and the Meaning of Remembrance, which will be released on April 17th. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you very much.
Also with us is Jeremy Best. He's an assistant professor of history at Iowa State University. He's working with the Ames Public Library and the Ames Historical Society to organize an interactive event for community members who want to assist with his Holocaust research as part of the Holocaust Museum's History Unfolded project. That's going to be at 6:30 on Monday, April 9th at the Ames Public Library. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Charity. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you both for being here today. And I want to ask you, as professors, people who encounter college students, you both teach about the Holocaust. I'm curious about what you find your students bring to the class on first day. How do they seem to understand the Holocaust in 2018 or 2017? Jeremy?
Well, in 2017, most students have some knowledge. They've heard of the Holocaust. They know a little bit about it. They know that it was violence against the Jews by the Nazis, and those are sort of abstract categories that they create. Beyond that, they really come with a lot of, in general, a lot of misconceptions about the specifics of the Holocaust and stories that drive that narrative.
And what are your thoughts, Dan?
Yeah, I would agree with Jeremy. I think that students certainly know something about the Holocaust. They know the general outline, perhaps, of the event, but when it comes to the details, there's less knowledge. Sometimes there are some misconceptions. I think it varies from student to student, of course. But I think there's also one thing I encounter. I don't know if Jeremy would agree, but I think there's a kind of sometimes a reluctance to engage with the subject because of its darkness. Perhaps the inherent what might be seen as pessimism or tragedy of the event. But I think that they're usually surprised by the kinds of debates that have sprung up around the Holocaust in the past 73 years also.
Well, yeah. And you say 73 years, which is actually recent history. It wasn't so very long ago.
Right.
But, I mean, Jeremy, do you feel like your students consider this to be ancient history?
I don't know if they consider it to be ancient history, but it's certainly the history of their grandparents or even their great-grandparents in some cases. I would echo Dan's point that I'd say that one of the goals in the Holocaust class that I teach here at Iowa State is to get past, when I ask a question about one of these debates or one of these issues, the initial answer that students will give in almost any context is, wow, I just can't understand that, and I don't get that. And what I want them to do is get well past that, because for since the Holocaust began, for more than 73 years, there have been historians and other scholars. Dan works in German studies, genocide studies, who have found answers to many of the questions that we ask. They may not be the completely right answer, but Holocaust studies and genocide studies has produced all kinds of meaningful information that can help us understand this event and make it meaningful in our own lives as a point of reference.
The kind of bewilderment that students approach the Holocaust with, the how could this ever happen, this could never happen again, is that what you're saying, that those questions actually have been answered, and by digging into it we can understand how it happened and how it could happen again?
Well, certainly the answer isn't complete, right? Scholarship is an ongoing process. We ask questions, we find better answers, we find new sources. But yes, there are answers to questions that are very easy, or not very easy, but very commonly asked by students. You know, how could someone have taken part in this? What was it that led Hitler and the Nazis to be able to carry this out? Those answers we can produce in a lot of detail. They're not always satisfactory, because sometimes the answer is, well, fundamentally people are flawed, and there's a risk of this in everyone, is at least the answer that I often come to.
Dan, you point out that really in the 1980s, the way we taught about the Holocaust, the way we learned about the Holocaust, really seemed to shift. What kind of shift do you think happened?
Well, there are a number of factors that lead to this shift, and it's often been referred to as a kind of memory boom, and it sort of manifests itself with a growing number of memorials and museums around the world, actually. But I think it's attributed to several factors. One is the fact that the Holocaust started to become much more openly discussed in the public forum, beginning in the 60s, but increasingly so through the 60s and 70s, culminating in the NBC broadcast of its miniseries Holocaust, which actually had a remarkable impact, not just in the United States, but internationally, in beginning a conversation about the Holocaust. So, you know, the flaws of the television show notwithstanding, it really played an important role in public discourse. And then we had other events happening throughout the 80s, ultimately the end of the Cold War and the opening of borders that had previously been difficult to cross. Also made access to Holocaust memorial sites that had lain on the other side of the Iron Curtain much more accessible. And so these factors in particular, I think, really have contributed to an explosion in memory. And then finally, I think, this memory boom shows no signs of abating. Numbers of people who are traveling to sites like Auschwitz-Birkenau, to the Memorial Museum there, are actually reaching record numbers still. And I think part of that is also explained by the awareness that the Holocaust is bound to disappear from lived memory, and that we're sort of on the cusp of a moment where it will recede into historical memory. And so I think there's a desire to, also on the part of people who travel or read or study the Holocaust, to learn as much as we can right now.
Well, and you have looked in depth into what you're calling Holocaust tourism, this boom in people visiting these sites around the world. And that's not without controversy. There are people that feel like it's somehow uncouth to
yes.
to visit these sites. What's the controversy? Why do you think people are uncomfortable with that?
Sure. It's a great question. I think part of it lies in just the nature of tourism itself is a phenomenon that we tend to treat with a little bit of suspicion. I think perhaps many of us have had the experience of traveling somewhere as part of a tour group and being embarrassed by the behavior of other tourists and wanting to distance ourselves from them. So there's a discomfort with, and an understandable discomfort with, the idea that you could purchase a ticket to a place like Auschwitz or Dachau or Buchenwald. And actually, technically speaking, those places are free of charge. But if you want to have a guided tour or use a headset, then you do have to pay a fee. So I think there's understandable discomfort around the tourism market as a feature of Holocaust remembrance. So I think what I'm trying to call attention to is the fact that while that may be a sort of almost unavoidable aspect of visits to places like this, that there still that does not erase the educational value of visiting these places. And actually, some of them do a very good job of informing their public, of engaging their visitors with uncomfortable aspects of history. So I don't think we'll ever be at a point where we're comfortable completely with the idea of going to a bookstore at a former concentration camp site. At the same time, I don't see that reality changing anytime soon.
So you've been to a lot of these places.
Yes.
What's the experience like for people who haven't been to Auschwitz or Buchenwald? What's the experience like when you visit?
Well, I think it certainly varies depending on the amount of preparation, maybe the age and maturity of the visitors, or the degree of any kind of personal connection to the history of the site, maybe because of survivors or victims in one's family. But I think that what is, I certainly remember the first time that I visited Auschwitz in 2007. I was traveling with a group of colleagues at Grinnell College. And even before the trip, we were very eager to discuss what our role would be on this site, that we would not be tourists, we were eager to tell ourselves, but that we were going as researchers and educators. And I think we were kind of surprised by the experience of pulling up to the entry in a bus, in a parking lot full of other buses, and seeing immediately a stand for selling books and purchasing refreshments near the place where one arranged one's guided tour. And I think we were also, I certainly was surprised, and I think many are, by the sheer number of people who are visiting. I think the numbers are currently at about 2 million a year going to Auschwitz, and the site is having a very difficult time managing the crowds. And so there's that uncomfortable initial encounter. And then I think once you kind of get through the gate, in a sense, I think the reality of the place is what is most shocking. I think for me what was very troubling was something I did not expect. It was a beautiful sunny day in the summer, and there was almost a kind of eerie, disquieting beauty about the place that seemed completely at odds with the experience, with the event that happened there. And that kind of troubling dissonance between everything that we know about the Holocaust and what we study, and then being confronted with its, I guess, its pastness, in a sense, the fact that it, you know, it's over and done with, it happened in the past, and nature has kind of reasserted itself over the site, is very disquieting.
We're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about how we learn about the Holocaust, how we remember the Holocaust. And with me, two professors in Iowa who are working to help their students connect to this atrocity. Dan Reynolds is the Seth Richards Professor of Modern Languages at Grinnell College, and Jeremy Best is an Assistant Professor of History at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now we're talking about how we learn about the Holocaust, how we remember the Holocaust. And with me are two professors who are helping their students connect to the Holocaust and this history. Dan Reynolds is the Seth Richards Professor of Modern Languages at Grinnell College. He's also the author of Postcards from Auschwitz, Holocaust Tourism and the Meaning of Remembrance, which will be released on April 17th. Jeremy Best is an Assistant Professor of History at Iowa State University, and we'll talk more about his History Unfolded project that he's a part of in just a moment. But Dan, just before the break, you were talking about your personal experience in going to Auschwitz and
yes.
and experiencing what it was like to visit the site of that horrible death camp and some of the cognitive dissonance that you felt being there with other tourists mm-hmm. and the trappings of tourism, the beauty of the day. But what do you think? I think feeling uncomfortable at that site makes a lot of sense. I mean, what do you feel like you and other people, maybe who aren't historians, would take away from that kind of experience?
Right. I think that's precisely where the value of visiting a place that like that lies is the sense of discomfort. I think the cognitive dissonance that can be experienced, I think, by most people who would visit the site, that it forces, I think, you as a visitor to reflect on your relationship to the Holocaust and to how it's remembered. And there's something about being there, observing other people at the site that causes one to reflect on how does one show reverence to the victims? How does one acknowledge the unbelievable suffering that took place there, but also recognizing that one's own entry into the site in no way approximates the experience that people had themselves who were interned in the camp, who experienced the camp, so that try as we might to get a deeper sense of understanding through tourism, there's always going to be a way in which we can't quite, we certainly cannot re-experience the event, and that who would want to, but I think the idea that tourism is a way of confronting the hard reality that this is something that occurred in our world, this in the space that we still inhabit, and that we come too late. We come too late to have prevented it.
Jeremy, with your students, I know that you're working to help them understand that although we have this sense of this history as far away and long ago, that it's something that Americans, Iowans, knew about as it was happening, right?
Yeah, sure. That's part of where the History Unfolded project has come in, and in many of my classes in this public event that we're doing next week, is that the History Unfolded is a project from the Holocaust Museum. It's a digital history project trying to connect local newspaper stories with a series of key Holocaust events over the period from 1933 to 1945. And one of the things that comes through in this project is the great quantity of coverage that Holocaust events received in American newspapers. And you asked us earlier about misconceptions that students bring to the table, and adults bring these too, or students are adults too, of course, but most of them. But that they bring to the table this sense that no one in America really knew what was going on. Maybe Roosevelt and his administration knew, maybe military leaders knew, but nobody else knew. And that's just patently false. We find coverage in newspapers, large and small, working with this project over the last couple of years, from the smallest towns will have articles detailing specifically news about the extermination of the Hungarian Jews, or reports that were made public in 1943 that by the Allied governments confirming that 2 million Jews had been killed up to that point in Europe. And so the by revealing to students that Americans reading the newspaper could have known and should have known, perhaps, they certainly had the information available to them, that forces students through this sort of, it's easy for them to imagine themselves as Americans in the past, and then suddenly students are taken out of a position of unbiased, unconnected observers to, through the link of historical empathy, a tool that I think is incredibly important in my classes, they're forced to put themselves in the position of observers and bystanders. And suddenly that is a different position to be in learning about the Holocaust than a unbiased distance.
Well, and it also explodes some of this mythology that we have about Americans as the liberators, which they were certainly part of the liberators of these camps. But the idea of the good guys versus the bad guys, this black and white that we like to paint our history in.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Holocaust studies, increasingly we find ourselves talking about the sort of the dirty victim and the clean perpetrator, and this sort of idea that, or not the idea, but the fact that these were human beings existing in a world where they were making decisions just like we do. And so that doesn't change the relationship in terms of guilt or blame, but it does change our ability to understand how things happened. The black and white, it's easier to simplify the story if you dwell in the black and white, like you suggested.
I want to get to the phones. You're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Lori is on the line in Clive. Hello, Lori.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for
calling. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. And so your mother-in-law was actually a Holocaust survivor.
Yes. She was in Buchenwald. She was in Dachau. And she was a teenager at the time, and she was used as labor.
And tell me a little bit about how she brought her story to Iowa.
She wanted to get an education, and so they sent her to Iowa with her husband and young daughter. And she went to Drake and got her teaching degree. And she started teaching with the Des Moines Public Schools. She taught at Roosevelt High School for many years in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. She didn't really talk about her experience, and even a lot of her students didn't know until her obituary came out in the paper. But she was also a teacher that would take students overseas for the student Foreign Study League. And one of the things was when the Anne Frank exhibit, the moving exhibit, came to the U.S., she had visited, and they did not really have a curriculum for high school students. So she wrote the curriculum for them and gave it to them, and they used it for many years.
Oh, wow. But you said this is something that a lot of her students didn't know. She didn't feel comfortable sharing her personal experience?
No. The way she dealt with it was to move forward. Life goes on. And she was a very strong woman. And towards the end of her life, I took care of her, full-time care of her. I left my job. And those demons, you know, those memories that she had pushed aside were coming back. And we sort of made a pact that she would tell me what had happened, and I would write it on paper, and therefore those stories couldn't those things couldn't hurt her anymore because they were on the paper. And we did this, you know, every few nights for 2 years. The papers that we wrote are in a safe deposit box, and I am her witness, and I am also the one that decides if and when that information will be released.
That must have been such a heartbreaking and difficult experience for both of you to relive those stories, but so important for you to help her work through those memories. What do you think you want to do with that record?
I'm not sure. What was interesting is that there was a 50-year age difference between the two of us. And so when she passed away, you know, this was a world. I grew up in a small rural Illinois town, and we learned about the Holocaust like most people did in a textbook. And so having to that firsthand knowledge, I actually almost started taking on some of her nightmares during this. Because it was just so vivid, And I'm not sure I want to dredge that back up for a while.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for sharing. And Jeremy, what Lori's sharing just reiterates the importance of these primary sources that you are sending your students toward.
Yeah, and I want to thank Lori for her care and for her sharing. And I would, before I further respond, I would, if Lori or anyone else out there who has these sorts of stories they'd like to share or connect with scholars or with the public, I'm available to facilitate that contact. But and you can find my contact information at Iowa State. But what these primary sources and these personal stories are invaluable. And Dan mentioned this sort of, we're having this movement of memory to historical memory and the loss of survivors as they pass away. And that's a real challenge in Holocaust education. I think for a long time, for good reason and for wonderful opportunities to bring survivors to classes, to bring them to campuses and communities to share their stories, illustrated that the events of the Holocaust very vividly for folks. And now we're having to find other ways to do that. And connecting people, students, community members to primary sources, primary documents is part of that. I think that is very much why I was so excited to discover this History Unfolded project and to work with the Holocaust Museum to deliver it as programming.
Dan, with the kind of remembrances that we have, the museums we can visit, and you know, these sites all over the world now, many of these places, including the Holocaust Museum, are working very hard to preserve these firsthand accounts. And they're doing some things in innovative ways to try to help the children of the future, the generations of the future, interact with survivors when there aren't survivors. But some people have some real concerns about this, where they're creating a hologram of a Holocaust survivor that a visitor to the museum can interact with and ask questions of, and they can respond. What are your feelings about that kind of technology being used to tell these stories?
Well, thank you. That's a great question. I think it's true that I think, and I, as Jeremy just mentioned, this moment of losing the Holocaust from lived the immediacy that we currently have in our ability to speak to survivors is something that museums and memorials also grapple with, and I think the desire to still be able to provide students and visitors with an educational experience is driving this desire to use new technology in innovative ways to recover the sense of immediacy that we're going to lose. And one of these, as you mentioned, is this idea of virtual Holocaust survivors. There are efforts underway to record survivor testimony, to interview survivors, ask them a number of questions and record their responses, and then through the use of an artificial intelligence algorithm, allow visitors to pose questions to this virtual survivor and have the most appropriate answer play back for the visitor. And I think, you know, there is always, the concern is the ability to sort of create something artificial out of this experience, and at what point does the testimony become something less than you know, the direct testimony of the survivor? Rather, it becomes something mediated, something computer generated, potentially something that could be falsified. The ability to manipulate media becomes a concern.
And in a world where there are people who deny that this happened, that's a really terrifying thing. And Jeremy, I want to ask you, Bill's on the line and we don't have time to take his call, but his question is, we often hear this reference to the Holocaust, but there have been other genocides. There have been other Holocausts. Why do you feel we talk about this event as the Holocaust?
Well, first, it's a matter of terminology and vocabulary. The Holocaust is really only a reference to the systematic and intentional murder of the Jews, along with Roma and Sinti, and the disabled in Europe in the years of World War II. But it certainly is the case that this is not the only genocide and not the only mass extermination program that's been pursued in the world. Why we talk about the Holocaust is—it's not the first. It's Holocaust or genocide in history, but it stands out as the most systematic, in my opinion, and the most industrialized. It's also its ambitions were some of the greatest that we see. Adolf Hitler and the Nazis had the intention to murder not just every Jew that they in Europe, but every Jew in the world and every Jew that they could get their hands on. When the Nazis were turned back, or sorry, the Nazis, the Germans and Italian forces were turned back in Egypt at the Battle of Tobruk, that ended plans that were in place to create a death squad, an Einsatzkommando, that would have gone into Palestine and murdered and exterminated the Jews there. There were plans for Einsatzkommandos to operate in every region that the Nazis that the Germans again and the Nazis intended to invade. So that is one reason why we talk about it differently. But the fact that there have been other genocides is why using at least one specific genocide to tell the story of how genocides happen is important, and that's why I think we do it.
Well, we are out of time, but Jeremy Best, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeremy Best, an assistant professor of history at Iowa State University. He's part of the Holocaust Museum's History Unfolded project, and he'll be holding a public event at the Ames Public Library 6:30 Monday, April 9th, to get the public involved with this kind of research. And Dan Reynolds, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dan Reynolds of Grinnell College. He is the author of Postcards from Auschwitz, Holocaust Tourism and the Meaning of Remembrance, which will be released on April 17th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Iditarod Sled Dog Race takes place every year in Alaska, every year since 1973, a 1,000-mile race from Anchorage to Nome. And while it may not be on the radar for most Iowans, this year, many Iowans were cheering for Team Max. Emily Maxwell is a musher who grew up in Iowa City and went to the University of Iowa. This was her first Iditarod. She lives in Alaska but is visiting Iowa right now. And here she is in the studio along with her dog, Koi, to tell us about her experience. Hello, Emily.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, you grew up in Iowa City. You went to the University of Iowa. This is not a place that most mushers come from. So tell me when you first encountered sled dogs.
So the summer of 2015, I was on a trip to Alaska with my brother. And 10-day trip, the second to last day, I met a musher named Nick Petit, who actually got second in this year's Iditarod race. And we kind of hit it off and started dating, you know, long distance because I came back to Iowa and was in school. And then I moved up the following January and didn't really have any interest in ever running this race. I just ran dogs with him and behind him and never alone, was scared to go alone. And then just sort of over a few years progressed, you know, pretty quickly to going out on my own runs, and then you also have to qualify for the Iditarod. So I had
Do you have to do to qualify?
So it's 2 300-mile races and a 150-mile race. There aren't a lot of 150s. Most people now do 200s. So I did those three races last winter there, and we did actually pretty well. Like I was top 10 in two of them, and then 11th in another one. And so that just kind of kept the motivation growing. And then I signed up. June is the sign-up day for Iditarod, so I signed up. Actually, I was here in Iowa, and I signed up online for the race.
Wow, and I think for a lot of people with a race like this one, I mean, such an iconic race, I'm guessing that a lot of the mushers, you would hear stories about how I've dreamed of doing this my whole life. It doesn't sound like that's your story at all.
No, and I sometimes feel a little bit guilty that they're like little kids that grow up dreaming of doing it and still never get the chance. And I kind of just fell into it, you know, unexpectedly. But I've been really lucky, and it is something that I really have fallen so deeply in love with. And I hope that I can do it for a long time.
So starting out, just helping out another musher with the sled dogs and then starting to go out on your own, what clicked? What happened that made you really fall in love with this sport?
I think the relationship with the dogs is what keeps you going and keeps you interested, even though there is a lot of, you know, there can be hardship. It's cold, obviously. You don't get a lot of sleep. A lot of times you're hungry or you're this or you're that, or you're just otherwise kind of uncomfortable. But it's easy to kind of put your needs aside and not think about them so much when you become really focused on the dogs. And then when you see their gratitude towards you, that, you know, you've fed them and massaged them and made their nice little straw beds for them at the checkpoints, it's just such a gratifying experience. I think that's, for me, the number one thing that has caused my interest to grow.
Well, tell me about your dogs. How many dogs do you have?
So Nick, we have about 45 dogs right now. That includes some puppies that were too small to run this year. But I took 15 dogs on the race. I think he started with 16. So, you know, over the course of the season, we go on smaller races and kind of decide who's going to take which dogs. So
how do you decide? What helps you put your team together?
I mean, partly he's quite competitive, and so he gets, you know, his pick. He gets
dogs,
the fastest,
right?
Dogs, yeah. And so then I kind of go with, you know, I had a strong, what they call the B team, but I had a good pool of dogs to choose from. Some that had run with me last year in my qualifiers and that I know really well, and then some that were newer and younger. I had three yearlings, so they're year and a half old siblings, and they all did really well, and they were fun to run. Puppies definitely keep it interesting.
Did you have dogs when you were growing up, like pet dogs?
Yeah, but kind of little, you know, yippy lap dogs. Nothing like, I always wanted to have a bigger dog. And then I actually had a border collie that my old boyfriend and I got together, and he moved to Alaska with me. So that was my first truly, you know, my as an adult pet.
So how would you characterize the difference between a person's relationship with a pet dog and your relationship with the dogs on your team?
It's funny. People always say, oh, they're working dogs. And I mean, and yes, they do work. But to us, they are definitely still our pets, you know, and we bring them inside and we love on them just the same as, you know, you would any pet. I think, you know, and I don't ever mean to diminish how much other people love their pets or how much their pets love them. But just the intensity of the relationship that you have with these dogs after you've gone through, you know, what we go through on these races, and especially on the Iditarod, it's just a very, I mean, you know, at the end of the race, when you're not around them 24/7, you get this like separation, you know, anxiety, and I think they do too. And so it's, you know, it's a very close relationship, and I think a very trusting relationship. And they always say, you know, if you take good care of your dogs will take good care of you. And that's really true.
How long does it take to train a dog to be on a team?
So we start training in the fall. And Nick actually runs a tour throughout the summer in Girdwood, Alaska. And so, you know, the dogs are running very short loops with tours, you know, a mile here, a mile there. So that keeps them kind of socialized, and they're getting harnessed and everything.
And during the summer, like on sleds with wheels? Or?
Yeah, it's a cart.
Okay.
So you can fit, I think, you know, depending on the size of people, 8 or 9 people on a cart, and they go for quick little rides and everything. So that kind of keeps the dogs, you know, socialized and active and running a little bit. And then we start training in the fall. So we'll start out, you know, just doing like a 4 or 5 mile run with them. And at that time, we're on a 4-wheeler until we get enough snow that we can be on sleds. And you just, I mean, the way a human would train, say, for a marathon, you just kind of slowly work your way up, and then you take some days off and keep building those miles. And so then in January, the kind of race season starts, you know, and we do anywhere from 50 to 300 mile races throughout the season.
I can imagine that this is incredibly intense for you, but it's also incredibly intense for the dogs. And I know a lot of people think, you know, this is not necessary anymore. Why are we putting dogs through this? What's your reaction to that?
It's, you know, I hear that a lot. And obviously PETA's a presence, you know, and they have a lot of opinions about what we do. And to me, I mean, it's just so obvious when you see these dogs in harness, they're so excited to go and they love it. And obviously they can run 1,000 miles. And I know it is, it seems baffling, but the way they're built, even physiologically, is so different from any other dog. And that's a big part of the reason why they're able to do it. And, you know, they say that we force the dogs to run. I mean, I can't force a dog to run any more than I can force you to go and take a lap around the block. You know, I mean, if they don't want to go, they'll let us know. And, you know, you either put them in the sled and carry them to the next checkpoint, and then they get to rest there, and then they get to fly home. So it's...
When you're out on a course, I mean, what do you do to make sure that their feet are in good shape and that they're in good health?
So every checkpoint we get into, you know, we have booties on their feet. You take the booties off. You check every single foot on every single dog. So you can imagine 4 feet per 16 dogs. So you spend a lot of time really, you know, looking at the pads, looking in the webbing of their feet. So their feet are really, really important, obviously, on a race. And we have creams and things that we put on them. You know, we give them massages. You know, you're always kind of like stretching their shoulders out, stretching their hips out, and checking for any sort of like if there's a wince, you know, you have a problem. So we do a lot of massage, you know, a lot of rest. And like I said, it's like your needs kind of come after all that, because you spend at least 2 hours when you get into a checkpoint kind of tending to their food and their beds and their, you know, their bodies and what's going on with their feet.
Now, it's a 1,000-mile race. You came in 33rd, mm-hmm. and you were out there for 11 days. Mm-hmm. Let's see, 11 days, 13 hours, 55 minutes, and 56 seconds.
So yeah.
This is a long journey, and I know you can't tell us about everything, mm-hmm. but what was the hardest part?
I think the hardest part, well, for the human overall, mentally, you go through a lot of ups and downs, you know, especially later you get into the race, you know, you're getting 2 to 4 hours of sleep, maybe a day. And so that kind of becomes this point of diminishing returns. And so emotionally, you know, you get tired, but you really have to like be there for the dogs and keep their spirits up. So even when you're feeling down, you're keeping your voice up like this and good dogs. All right, guys, go ahead. Probably specifically on this race, maybe I would say the most scared I ever was. I was by myself, no other mushers on the trail near me, and I was going through kind of a whiteout storm just before getting into Shaktulik, was the checkpoint, and it's on the Bering Sea coast. And so in this whiteout storm, I almost, you know, can barely see my leaders, and we have trail markers along the trail so you can, you know, navigate. And those, a lot of them had been blown down or broken off. And so, you know, I was kind of, the dogs were weaving back and forth, and I kept calling them and calling them to each trail marker, and it was stressful. And I finally realized they were becoming stressed because of my stress, you know, at kind of over commanding like where to go. And so I finally took a deep breath. I'm like, they know what to do, and they can smell that scent trail. And you just need to let them do their job. And after that, everything was fine. But it was, you know, a little bit
scary. So you
were
afraid you were going to lose the trail.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the wind was such that, you know, there was really no trail right there. The snow had been blown in over it. And so just, you know, you have no point of reference out there because I was kind of on this inlet. There's no trees. You know, you're on ice under the snow and the Bering Sea is right here. You know, and obviously we have trackers on the sled. So if you got lost, you know, they know where you are. You're not really alone, but it was definitely the scariest
not
moment
like
of that
you
race.
Would have been in 1973.
Yes, I know exactly. It's like I'll never feel like I'm very tough for doing it this year after what they went through in the 70s.
I think you've earned some cred. You actually on the first day, you lost your GPS unit.
Oh, I thought I did. I had just bought a little handlebar mount for the GPS, and I was like, oh, this is so great, because normally I have it in my pocket, and you're taking it in and out, and I was always worried I'm going to drop this thing, and you really, really need your GPS. So I had this mount and was excited, and I put it, you know, down on the mount, and shortly before getting to Corral Hill, which is this sort of notorious hill on the first run, and just before we were going to drop down to the river, I looked down and the GPS is not there. And I mean, I didn't know what I was going to do. I was terrified that I had lost it. And I looked down thinking maybe it was in front of my drag mat on the ground and it wasn't there. And I mean, I was almost in tears. And then I had this light bulb go off and I leaned forward and I looked down into my sled bag and it had fallen down into the sled. And after that, I did not use that bar mount. It was in my pocket the rest of the race. Yeah.
Tell me about the Gorge, which is one of these really legendary places on the Iditarod Trail.
Yeah, so this is probably the most technical part of the trail in terms of driving your sled and your dogs. And it's basically, you know, downhill. It's hard to say. I think it's about 2.5 hours that it takes, although time, you know, out there gets a little funny. And I was going through at night, and it's a really twisty, windy, a lot of downhill and trees all over the place, lots of things to potentially run into and tip over. It was kind of fun. We had a lot of snow this year, which helps in that section because years past they've only had dirt, and it's really hard to control your sled if you don't have anything to break into. So sure. We had good snow, so that was lucky.
Which would actually help you go slower than lack of snow.
Right. Which, you know, the dogs are really excited and they're going downhill. So, I mean, you're trying to keep them at a pace that's, you know, manageable to drive the sled and also keeps, you know, them safe and their shoulders and wrists and everything happy. So, you know, I was going as slow as I could without running into a tree. We actually did have one moment where I did tip the sled. It's kind of every year they make a movie about the Iditarod from that year, and the spot is always in the movie. There's always a camera crew out there because people tip, and it's kind of your comedic moment. So we're coming around this U-turn. So even before I'm into the turn, my dogs are already over to my left going the other way. So it's quite a sharp turn. And it's right there pretty slick on the ice. And on the other side of that turn, there's like a hole that goes down into open water. And so I come around and we're starting to tip. And all I did was try to lean as far away from that hole as I could. And luckily did not go in. But then, you know, I'm getting dragged on my belly, holding onto the sled, which is on its side. And then you don't have your brake because, you know, you should be upright.
You are the brake.
Yes, exactly. Are you trying to be? And of course you're yelling, whoa, whoa, but they're really excited. And so they're taking off, and you have two snow hooks that are kind of your brakes that you can put down into the ground that allows you to get off the sled when you need to. So those were kind of like bouncing around on the ground in front of me. And so I grabbed one and slammed it into the ground, which allowed me, you know, it stopped them and it allowed me enough time to get the sled upright. And just as I did, they, you know, were slamming so hard to go that it popped that hook and we took off. And just out of the corner of my eye in the darkness, I could see a snow machine, or we would call it a snowmobile here, but I see a snow machine, and I was pretty sure that there was the camera crew sitting out there with like the night vision camera. So we'll see if I make the movie this year.
So tell me what it means to you to have completed this race.
I mean, I feel like I'm still processing it. You know, it's sometimes I have a hard time believing that it was me and not someone else. But I think, you know, for only having gone up there 2 years ago, you know, I've learned a lot. And there were times before the race that I thought, you know, I mean, my confidence kind of, you know, was on a roller coaster. But once we got out there, it was really, I mean, it was a dream. The dogs were so happy the whole time. They ate so well the whole time, which is really important. And so, you know, it's like your children. Like, if they're happy, you're happy. And if you're happy, that, you know, it was just this really good, positive give and take. So, yeah, I think, you know, and for only 2 years having done it, and to get to know those dogs so well and to be able to say you really ran that race with some of your best friends. Yeah, I think I'm really happy that I did it and that we finished. And, you know, I would love to do it again.
You would.
Yeah.
You would go back.
Yeah. And maybe not for until next year. But but yeah, I would love to do it again.
Well, Emily Maxwell, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
And Koi is with you. She's been very quiet. She was on the Iditarod. She ran the whole thing with you?
Yeah, and she finished. Yep, and it was only her first time. She's 2 years old, so she did amazing.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Emily Maxwell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily Maxwell completed the Iditarod this year. She took 33rd. She grew up in Iowa City, went to the University of Iowa, but lives in Alaska. Her day jobs are teaching Pilates and being a waitress, but she's out there with the dogs. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.